And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Oh, life is bigger. It's bigger than you, and you are not me.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Norris.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
To the best crew any captain ever had, this may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. For Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the season-ending episode of Listen to the Prophets, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast, hosted by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. And for nearly 9 months, we've been covering the highs and lows, move along home, of the first season, and now it comes down to this, the final episode for season one, in the hands of the prophets. Will it be a letdown of an episode? Will it introduce new and interesting characters and villains to the show? Will Bashir finally stop being an annoying ass clown? Well, one thing for certain, we'll let you know in due time. And by we, of course, I mean myself, Sean Engel, and my two co-hosts, Vedic Andrew Leyland and Vedic Paul Spataro. Hey, guys, how's it going?
I will manipulate whatever I have to become Kai.
Whereas I'm probably the last person you want as a Kai.
So, do you want me to melt someone in a power coupling and hopefully work on assassinating Andy later today, Paul?
Well, I don't know if "work on" is the appropriate thing. Either okay. You do or you do not do. There is no try.
Oh, I guess. Man, that's stream a big crossing cross the streams. Yeah. Well, we don't have anything Star Trek to talk about this time out. There's nothing really going on. We don't know much about the new series, or not the new series, the new movie.
I wish there was a new series.
Yeah.
So do I.
There had been talk for the longest time of Netflix picking, since Netflix has essentially all the Star Trek shows in their entirety for viewing on Netflix, that would make sense for Netflix to do like they're doing with the Marvel properties, the Daredevil and Jessica Jones and, you know, the Defenders and all that, to pick up a Star Trek series. You know, and it doesn't have to be incredibly high budget. It could be just very simple, one-off episodes, and I wouldn't mind seeing that. And they could do it in the Netflix model of just release it, you know, 13 or so episodes all at one time. But I don't know if that's ever going to happen. I would like it to, but not holding my breath.
Yeah, I don't see Star Trek going over to Netflix. I'll be surprised if that happens. But because, if nothing else, just because of the Paramount licensing, I don't know if they'd be quick to relinquish control. Maybe if they did it similar to what Marvel's doing and doing a kind of a joint effort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where basically I think, you know, Paramount would be producing it and Netflix would just be the means of delivery. I could see that being, you know, some sort of a way of doing it. But I don't think Netflix would actually be the producing company.
Well, I say that because Netflix, not only do they have all of the episodes of the various different shows from the original series to Next Gen, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise, but they're also showing, I know currently in the rotation, they have the second Abrams movie, Into Darkness, plus they've got a pretty good number of the original series movies. You know, I think they've got A Wrath of Khan. I'm pretty certain they have three on there. I know they have Undiscovered Country, and they've got a couple of the Next Generation ones. available for viewing. So with such a big number of Star Trek properties on Netflix, for them to come up, if Paramount wanted to do an ongoing show, whether it be necessarily with a Star Trek crew or whether it be with the new Star Trek, it wouldn't be unheard of for Netflix to take on and do that, or at least in some way help out with Paramount to do that. I wouldn't mind it, personally.
I wouldn't mind it. It's not a matter of that. It's a matter of the legal and licensing logistics probably getting in the way a little.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I think Paramount is very protective of its rights. And I think they'd be concerned about what exactly they'd be giving to Netflix if Netflix was producing the episodes. Like I said, if it was just a means of delivery, I don't necessarily think that's, you know, unworkable. But I think Paramount would want to have full control over the production.
I don't think you're going to have anything like that while J.J. Abrams is doing the movies. I'm sure I've read somewhere that he clamped down on them developing a television show and them being a series of novels based upon New Trek, probably because he didn't want to be shown up by proper writers. So I don't think you're going to get anything like that. Which is a shame, because there are so many delivery models now for us to have that Captain Sulu movie or that Captain Worf movie or whatever. But no, I think that at the moment they've let him have far too much control.
Oh, I agree with you there. That he, you know, it's always a mistake when you give one guy, especially a guy who is not, you know what? I'm gonna back up on that. You give one guy, under any circumstances, total control over those franchises, anything at all. When Gene Roddenberry had total control and they went to do The Next Generation, they had some problems with the fact that he was unwilling to adjust on certain ends. You had the same thing occur with George Lucas when he got to the prequel movies. When you have one guy, even a guy who created the series in the first place, which J.J. Abrams is far from that, but when you have one guy who has total control over it, they start becoming a little myopic in their views of things, and they're not willing, you know, they surround themselves with yes men, and they're not willing to make adjustments as necessary. I think a lot of people, that would be the issue that they'd have with Christopher Nolan and Batman as well.
Yeah, I can agree with that. It's when you get someone who's single-minded and they're in control of this big franchise. Again, I think you made perfect examples with both Batman, Star Trek, and Star Wars. When you get someone in there just completely controlling it and running it and not allowing any people to come in and give their own opinions of what might better serve the story, then it's doing a disservice to that franchise. So, yeah.
I don't know. I think the fact that the Broccolis have kept such a tight fist around the James Bond series has been to its benefit.
We haven't had a young James Bond yet. Right. Yeah, but I don't think that they've shown that unwillingness to listen to others. And I think they've steered wrong on occasion. You know, to me, it's much like some other things where even bad James Bond is watchable for me. But I think, you know, they've shown, at some points where, you know, where they got into the, okay, the gadgets have to be bigger and bigger and bigger every time, to the point where they've gotten occasionally very, very silly and taken it from what people wanted to see. They've been stubborn sometimes on their casting of Bond. I think they've done a wonderful job, and I love the Bond series. I don't want to be blasting it, but I think there's been times where they've had missteps as well.
No, I could agree with that. I think Bond benefits from having multiple characters play the role of James Bond. With Star Wars and Star Trek, you know, especially the reboot of Star Trek, you have the same characters, and because you can't have the same actors portray them in perpetuity, you get a kind of disconnect, I guess, and it feels out of place. The idea of James Bond being a different person and having that person bring their own individual feel to it, I think helps in the Bond series rather than how it does in like Star Wars or Star Trek, if that makes any sense. It's early in the morning.
Still.
Yes. So do we want to go ahead and head into the synopsis?
Yeah.
All right.
A religious extremist.
You want nothing less than to destroy us.
Sets off a wave of terror.
I understand my duty to defend the Bajoran faith.
A holy war that could divide the station.
I think I've given you all the support I can, short of...
It's not enough.
And bring the Federation to its knees.
We are neither the enemy nor the devil.
We'll see.
Next time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
This one was called, called In the Hands of the Prophets. It it was the 20th and last episode of Season 1 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and it aired on June 20th, 1993 in the United States. It was written by Robert Hewitt Wolfe and directed by David Livingston. The main cast was joined by Louise Fletcher as Vedic Wynn, Philip Anglim as Vedic Beryl, Rosalind Cho as Keiko O'Brien, and Robin Christopher as Neela. And once again, I'm taking my synopsis from the Star Trek Deep Space Nine Companion by Terry J. Erdman and Paula M. Block. A new day begins on Deep Space Nine, and Chief O'Brien escorts his wife Keiko through the promenade on her way to the station school. O'Brien pauses to purchase a snack at a kiosk and impresses Keiko with his knowledge of Bajoran Jumja sticks, although not quite in the way she intended. The trivia about Jumja came from his new assistant, Neela, and O'Brien is startled when he realizes that Keiko thinks that he might be attracted to the pretty Bajoran. After a bit of teasing, Keiko heads on into the classroom. As Keiko attempts to explain the scientific principles behind the construction of the nearby wormhole to her students, she is interrupted by the arrival of Vedic Wynn, a spiritual leader from Bajor. Wynn observes the lesson, then calmly states her opposition to Keiko's secular method of instruction, which does not touch upon Bajoran beliefs regarding the prophets who reside in the wormhole. Keiko reports the incident to Commander Sisko, and Kira expresses some support for Wynn's point of view. When Keiko rejects the idea that she incorporate religious beliefs into her curriculum, Kira suggests that there may be a need for a separate school for Bajoran children. Sisko doesn't like that idea, since he wants to see Bajoran and Federation interests unified. Uncertain how to resolve the matter, Sisko goes to see Wynn, who warmly greets the quote-unquote emissary, as the late Kai Opaka referred to the commander. But Wynn refuses to back down from her stance that Keiko has dishonored the Celestial Temple with her teachings. Wynn informs Sisko that she won't be responsible for the consequences if the teacher does not recant. Working with Neela, O'Brien is concerned to discover that one of his tools is missing. The tool can be used to access every critical system on the station. Curiously, an engineer named Aquino is missing also. A search of a power conduit leads O'Brien and Neela to the remains of both the tool and the unlucky ensign. The working theory is that Aquino had attempted to repair a plasma flow irregularity in the conduit and got caught in the power flow, but O'Brien is unsatisfied with that answer. He is even more troubled when he finds out that Wynn's veiled threat has come to fruition. Some of the Bajorans on the station have begun to treat Keiko with contempt. Wynn continues to stir up the Bajorans with their superficially passive rhetoric and confronts Keiko at the door to the school. She will accept Keiko's decision not to teach the students about the prophets if Keiko promises not to teach anything about the wormhole at all. Keiko can't accept that alternative, and she watches in dismay as Wynn leads the Bajoran children and their parents away from the school. Concerned, Sisko pays a visit to Vedic Beryl, the leading candidate to become the next Kai on Bajor. Sisko hopes that Beryl can help him arrange an audience with the Vedic Assembly so that he can discuss the school, but while Beryl's ideology is very different from Wynn's, he does not want to risk his political future on appearing to take sides with Sisko. Frustrated, Sisko returns to the station, where he discovers several Bajoran crew members have failed to report for duty. When Kira refuses to offer her support in resolving the situation, Sisko has some sharp words with her. A short time later, Odo and Bashir report the results of their investigation into Aquino's death. The ensign was killed by a phaser blast. Odo has made an additional discovery. On the night he was killed, Aquino did not head for the power conduit, as his log indicates. He went to runabout pad C. O'Brien and Neela investigate the pad, but find nothing. After Neela leaves, O'Brien runs an additional diagnostic on the runabout pads and finds someone has placed a security bypass module at pad A. He informs Odo, and the shapeshifter quickly deduces that Aquino was killed when he interrupted someone tampering with the security net at pad C. The murderer then switched his efforts to pad A to avoid detection. As the pair attempt to figure out the motive behind the subterfuge, they hear an explosion and discover the empty schoolroom engulfed in flames. Angered by Wynn's insincere concern over the incident, Sisko accuses the Vedic of instigating animosity and resulting violence on the station in an effort to increase her following among the Bajoran people. But her attempt will fail, he tells her, because the majority of Bajoran people on the station have come to know that, for all their differences, the representatives of the Federation are not the enemy. Later, Neela approaches Wynn in private and tells the Vedic that the officers have found out about the runabout, leaving her no method of escape. But Wynn suggests that if it was the will of the prophets that the plan continue, even if that means a sacrifice on Neela's part. In the meantime, Sisko is pleasantly surprised when Brile arrives at the station to help the commander, quote-unquote, clean up the situation. As Kira and Sisko escort Brile through the promenade, Dax and O'Brien find a mysterious subprogram in the computer that has created a series of force field overrides from the promenade to run about Pad A, an escape route for someone. Other clues suggest that the weapon detectors on the promenade have been disabled by Neela. Brile and Wynn address the throng of Bajorans outside the remains of the school, and Brile counsels tolerance and acceptance of new ideas. After O'Brien alerts Sisko about the weapons detectors and his suspicions about his assistant, the commander spots Neela in the crowd with a phaser in her hand. He knocks her to the ground, causing her to miss the target, Brile. Stunned, Kira realizes that all of Wynn's activities were a ruse to bring Brile to the station, where he could have be assassinated before he became Kai. But Neela insists that she acted alone, following the will of the prophets. Later, a humbled Kira tells Sisko that she heard his earlier words to Wynn and agrees with him. And Sisko happily observes that they've made some progress after all. All right.
The end.
The end.
And then the show was cancelled because it was on Fox, and it was never seen again.
Well, luckily,
you're wrong.
Luckily, it was in syndication. Even though in my neighborhood, in my neck of the woods, it was being aired on Fox. So thankfully, it didn't suffer the fate that many first season shows on Fox did. So there you go.
Very good.
What do we think about this one, guys?
I have two feelings, and they combat each other, but one does ultimately win. The first feeling is, so Frank Ocean was black on the right and left and white on the left.
What does that
second
mean?
Feeling, I'm sorry.
This is a bit more subtle than that, but go on. Give us your second feeling.
My second feeling is Nurse Ratched. That's almost as good as Andy Robinson. Okay.
Oh yeah, Louise Fletcher in this role is this is the role she was meant to play. I mean, she is just. And to know what's going to happen with her throughout the rest of the series is just to get her in this episode this early in the show is just amazing. And I love how she's just so deceitful and so politically motivated, and much
just
like the
so
Cardassians.
Syrupy in her delivery, where she's condescending and she just
queen
of
passive
aggression.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, what'd you say, Andy?
The queen of passive aggression.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. She's, I just think she's a marvelous character. And she's not Garrick, but damn, she's good. and she's what saves the not so subtle message. But even at that, the issue of separation of church and state and the issue of, teaching religious views in a scientific class, those are very real issues. And they're presented here in a way where, how does it affect the station? We have a culture on Bajor that's dominated by religious belief. And we have a culture in the Federation that's dominated by scientific studies. So a clash is inevitable. And I think it's presented pretty well here. So now you know which side won out.
I think it's presented very well, because Keiko doesn't even see it as being a religious issue. it's Wynn who brings that to the table. And we had a brief discussion about this on Facebook after I watched it. And one of the things I liked about it, the episode doesn't say religion is bad, because Baril, I never pronounce his name properly. He is of the same religious denomination as Wynn. But he's a decent guy, and he's open to other philosophies. Wynn's philosophy is, I'm right, you're wrong, but I've done everything in my power to see it your way, and I wash my hands of the whole affair. Whatever happens now is on your head. And then especially when you realise as the episode goes on, she didn't give a toss about Keiko's school. This is all political motivation to get her opponent out the way.
Mm-hmm. And I like that, you know, the conflict between, you know, Keiko and Baril is mediated specifically by Sisko. And I think Sisko does a great job in this episode of being sort of the voice of reason between all of them. And every time that, you know, there's a confrontation, whether it be with Jake saying how silly it is about the Bajorans not realizing that the wormhole is artificially created, or at the end of the series where he's talking with Kira and saying that, you know, your religion matters as well, that he's there to provide that sort of middle ground to show that we don't have to be so polarized over this, that we can reach common ground in that. And I like that development of the character of Sisko throughout this show, that he's come to realize that he has to make compromises between these two differing ideals. And I think it's done really well in this episode.
And I like that when he goes to Baril in the middle of the episode, Baril, despite being a decent guy and being open to other philosophies as well of his own, he doesn't want to touch this political hot potato.
Mm-hmm. He's as political as Wynn, but he's not as fundamental as Wynn. You know, he realizes that if he sides with one side or the other, he's going to lose favor by a certain number of people who would vote. I don't know whether it's vote or whatever they do to make him the Kai. So he's playing the long game as well, but he's at least more understanding than Wynn is.
Because Keiko doesn't even see this as a religious issue. She's simply teaching the wormhole to the people. And if they want to believe that it's part of their belief system that they're a wormhole, what's it, then she's fine with that. She has no problem with it. But Kira's reaction is great as well when Kira says, well, maybe you should change your lesson plan. But Kira's never said that she has a problem with it till Vedic Wynn comes on board and has a problem with it.
Hmm. Well, and I think to be honest, both sides in Keiko and Wynn are somewhat intractable. They both don't want to give ground. I think obviously Keiko is a bit more understanding. She's like, we can also teach religion if you want, while Wynn is like, you either teach religion or nothing. So this is like every Facebook argument essentially ever.
And Wynn's problem was not only do you have to teach our way, you cannot teach your way.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it becomes closed, you know, where she becomes totally closed-minded. Because if she had said, hey, you could teach that this is a way of doing it, and this is a way of believing it, and this is a way of believing it, I don't think there ever would have been an issue. I think Keiko would have said, okay, I can make that compromise. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I mean, I grew up in a very varied background, as I went to Catholic elementary school, followed by Catholic high school, followed by Catholic university. But quite frankly, in my course of studies in the religion classes I took, they always taught the other religions. They would teach in Judaism, this is what they study and this is what they believe and this is how they present it. And in, you know, Buddhism, this is what they present. I remember that in the classes, and I was kind of thrown back off by it a little bit, saying, wait a minute, this is a Catholic school. Why am I learning about these other religions? Mm-hmm. But in hindsight, it makes sense that, you learn what other people's beliefs are. I kind of always felt, you know, I've had this debate with people, and people feel very strongly about it. There are people out there who are creationists, And I'm not going to debate the merits of that or the deficiencies of that on any level. But I never thought it was a problem to teach in school, you know, this is the Big Bang Theory, and this is what we believe is the case. This is what creationists believe. You know what I mean? I never thought that was a problem to say that. I don't really understand why people have a fundamental problem with just saying this is what they believe. You don't have to believe it.
See,
no one's saying you have to.
I really enjoy this episode because I don't know if this episode's going to really engender a whole lot about the episode, but it's engendering the idea of this sort of debate between, you know, science versus religion. And this is one of the things that the Deep Space Nine is excellent about approaching. And this is where we kind of get really into it here. And I think it's done in a really reasoned manner. Both sides are given their points of view. Obviously, Wynn's is far more fundamental, but it puts the idea out there and allows for discussion and allows for, you know, you having to try and reason out why one side would be more right than the other. And that's what good science fiction should do. It should make you think about what's being presented on the show or in the book or in whatever media that's being played and make you activate your brain. And this is what Deep Space Nine does really well.
Well, I always
thought that if in a class, if they tried to focus on this, you know, this is scientifically a fact and this is what it is, especially when you're talking about something like the wormhole, that's arrogant. Because, you know, my example of that is if you went back far enough into the past, they would have taught you science shows us that the world is flat and that if you go far enough, you'll fall off the edge. And so to ever say, you know, based on science, we know that this is what it is to preclude the idea that we have more to learn.
Mm-hmm. I think the idea of fundamentalism of any type, whether it be fundamentalism in science or fundamentalism in religion, is really doing a disservice to trying to gain knowledge. It basically stagnates you. You might say that fundamentalism in science, since science is actually the pursuit of knowledge and the advancement of it, is probably a bit more realistic. But if you deny anything else going on, then you're setting yourself up for trouble.
Yeah, that's my thing. I just have a problem with closed-mindedness.
Yes.
And the conversation that you two are both having is the point of the episode. The problem is not religion or faith. The problem is that Wynn wants everyone to believe what she believes.
Exactly.
And her will is to be imposed on everyone, and everybody else's belief is wrong. Mm-hmm. And your conversation is what the show's about, which is why I've just kind of sat back and listened to it.
Well, surprise, that's amazing. Someone's actually listening to me. That's that happens. That only happens on podcast. Great. This podcast.
It's a lot more subtle than some other episodes of Star Trek that have tackled religion, because Gene Roddenberry's on record as saying, as far as he's concerned, the crew of The Next Generation are atheists. He told Jonathan Frakes that, apparently, when they started filming. And his view of organized religion is on display in any number of other episodes. And I often thought those episodes were heavy-handed, because they were his views. And to me, that's no different than what Kai Wynn's doing here. You're an idiot for believing that stuff. My way is the right way. Mm-hmm. And I thought this one was actually quite well balanced. I said to you both on Facebook, I appreciated that it was...
It's well balanced while showing people who have over-the-top views, or showing person who has over-the-top views. Mm-hmm. And that's difficult to do. And again, I give credit to the writers like I have in some other episodes.
Yeah, and Louise Fletcher's performance as well. Her performance as that syrupy school mom is just brilliant, even if she does have Sydney Opera House on her head.
Yeah, and they said in the companion that supposedly the design element wasn't taken from the Sydney Opera House, but I can't see how you can look at that headpiece and not think that. It's just so unique.
Subconsciously. It may not have been intentional, but it is a magnificent hat.
Very much so. And I wonder if it's kind of, not to put a too fine a point on it, but her headpiece, she's the only one who wears this sort of fundamental headpiece that covers not only her head, but a lot of her hair. And whether that in some way is a relation to the hijab that very devout Muslim people wear, or very devout Islamic people wear, and how it's basically giving you a visual cue to the highly fundamental group that we have in, here on planet Earth, here in the Middle East, here in, these people who are very strictly believing in their religion and associating that with these characters on Deep Space Nine. I'm wondering if that was kind of a visual cue there. Maybe.
Well, there's a scene in the middle of the episode where Keiko's school gets firebombed.
Mm-hmm. So,
it's very hard not to see that now, yeah, 20 years after the episode was made, and draw parallels with what's still going on.
And there is a mention of terrorism in there. So yes, I don't think it's a leap in any way to think that that's one of the major themes that you're trying to get at in the show.
But let's not forget, Kira has described herself as a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't think terrorists
way.
Ever think of themselves as terrorists, though.
Well, she's described what her actions as that in hindsight. At the time, she just considered herself a liberator.
Yeah, freedom.
And I think it may have been somebody else who pointed out to her that what you were doing, the acts that you were doing, etc. But to me, it's more emblematic of what the show did as it went on from this point. These last two episodes essentially steer the show in the direction that it will go over the next 6 years, and exploring that idea, exploring the Bajoran faith versus the science of the wormhole versus freedom fighting versus terrorism versus the Cardassians versus the other race that end up showing up, the Jem'Hadar and all of that stuff, and the Maquis and everything. This is what this did best, and it seems like it's took us a full season to actually get to where we are now going, yes, this is what the show is going to be going forward. These last two episodes are what we're going to be about.
And we've built up to this. We've had little clips and little bits of this is what the Bajor occupation was like. This is what the Cardassians did. We really haven't had a whole lot of religion except in... which episode was it? The Battle Lines?
Oh, where they went to the wormhole and they killed Kaio Paga.
Yeah, well, they killed her, but she was alive.
Yeah.
Excuse me. That was really the only one where we really saw the religious implications of it. And now, so what they're doing, as I see it, is they're building on it. They're taking little bits that they gave you about how this occupation affected Kira personally, or how the occupation affected Cardassians personally, and now they're expanding it and showing how it's affected the culture and the world and how they're looking at it politically. And it's just really is, I think, a really, really good season ender, because it leaves you wanting to know, where are we going to go from here? It's not a cliffhanger, but it kind of is just the same.
Yeah, it's showing you where we're going from this point. The show's finally found its feet. And I don't think this first season was as rough as the first season of Next Generation.
No.
But it certainly had moments where it's clear that the producers just thought that this was just going to be a Next Generation spin-off, and we can put characters from Next Generation in it, and we can tell exactly the same types of stories. And slowly, over the course of the year, they've actually started going, wait a minute, none of that's working. This is its own thing. And then they started treating it as such. And these last two episodes, that all finally comes together.
I think the necessity of Deep Space Nine being in one place, I think the absence of a ship to travel to different places sort of was a necessitized the idea of them having to have these elements of what's going on in Bajor and what's going on with the Cardassians to be part of the plot. With Next Gen and with the original series and with Voyager, since they're traveling throughout space and everything, they can encounter new things. They can encounter new planets, and they can have different adventures on different episodes. to let this station, which is situated in one place, have an interest.
Station! Sorry, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
But to have this in set in one place, you have to deal with the surroundings around the station, and you have to put some intrigue in that. And this is where politics and religion really enhance this show and really make this show a heck of a lot different than what we've seen in previous iterations of Star Trek. And it's what makes it, for me, it's what makes it at sometimes better than previous iterations of Star Trek.
Yes. Sorry, I got distracted by the "be right back."
No problem.
No, that's, yeah. I don't really have any much to add to this one. I thought it was a really good season finale without actually being a forced cliffhanger.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at any of my notes. I did mention the scene between Jake and Ben. This did, I know Paul kind of mentioned at the beginning, this did have the possibility of becoming a really preachy episode, and the conversation or the speech that Sisko gives at the end could be kind of like the speech that he gave at the end of A Man Alone, which was the second episode after the two-part pilot, where he's there basically saying, you shouldn't judge Odo because he's different, and people who are different can be okay. It had some of the feeling of it did have some of the heavy-handedness of that delivery, but I think because we've had more character interaction, we have the characters know each other a lot better, that it didn't come off as, like I said, heavy-handed or forced as it did in that episode.
I didn't think it did at all. I mean, we joked on the first conversation that I've texted both of you two and said, was there a subtext in the hands of the prophets? Because it just went completely over my head. But I thought they did a pretty good job of straddling that line. That's the risk you run when you're telling allegorical science fiction stories. That at some point it will be like Paul keeps saying, yeah, Frank Goshen's black on the right. Yeah. It will become too much of that. I felt this walked the line very well.
Yeah, I think it did. I joke around that it was heavy-handed because the subtext was not subtle.
Oh, no, by any means.
But just the same, I thought it was presented in a way that was not unrealistic for, you know, for the setting that we're in. I thought it was presented well. I think, like you said, it was kind of even-handed in the way they presented the different points of view, from fundamentalist to reasonable to, you know, basically crazy. And it was thought-provoking, and that's what you want. Isn't that one of the main ideas of science fiction, is to be thought-provoking? And there's, yes, not a lot of science in this one, although, you know, there is the question of, you know, well, how did this wormhole really come into existence? You know, they believe that it was deities that created it, and the Federation people believe that, you know, they're not deities, they're just beings with powers superior to ours. That doesn't make them gods, or however you want to view them. But it gets you thinking about it. Not only does it get you thinking about that, but it also gets you thinking about the political ramifications of it, and it gets you thinking about that really, really well. And then how far will somebody go to, you know, who aspires for political power to get political power? Clearly, Kai Winn, there's nothing that's below her, and we will see more of her as it goes on. And I think she's one of the best villains that I know, because she's the villain who stands next to you and pats you on the back and tells you how wonderful you are. And yet her motivations are not pure. Her motivations, and we see them more and more as it goes on, that she aspires to power. And not only does she aspire to power, she wants to be important. She wants to be loved. She wants to be the savior of Bajor. She wants to be in the history books when it's all said and done. Yep. You know, her aspirations are for the wrong motivation.
Which brings up another interesting subtext that we'd not talked about, how this is critiquing how the political game is played. mm-hmm. on Bejo, and by extension, how it's played here in the 21st century.
Yep, you can definitely make correlations to how the political posturing on this show is very on the nose of how political posturing is in pretty much any, you know, not only in the United States, but I'm certain in Great Britain, the way people, you know, make friends,
yeah.
you know, have enemies and everything. It's not only great science fiction, it's great just political fiction as well. It's
yeah. Well, really we're seeing good. All of this at the moment. We are 100 days away from a general election, which the news keeps telling us, and it's nothing but posturing, scum, flat-faced, bland politicians in boring suits going around pretending that they know the common man. Our beloved Prime Minister at the moment is just touring around with his hard hat on, visiting hard-working people on building sites and doing all of that stuff because there's an election coming up. Mm-hmm. He's not done it for the past 4.5 years, but now there's an election coming up, suddenly he's interested in the common man.
Everything changes.
Yeah, that's this show is just about political maneuvering as it is about religious fundamentalism and science and their relation to each other. That's why I think this one is actually quite an impressive episode.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I joked early on about the heavy-handedness of the message, and like I said, I don't think it was at all subtle, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think it's quite good.
The news isn't subtle. Politicians aren't subtle.
Yeah, true. Did we see Morn? I did not.
Yes, he was... He, you know, in the first, let me pull up my notes, in the first 30 seconds of the show, as Keiko and Chief O'Brien are walking away with their Jumja sticks, he walks behind them, and you see him in a couple of other scenes.
I did see that. I forgot. You're right. I did see him behind them.
I think he's also, as Vedic Barile comes onto the station, he's one of the people there to greet Vedic Barile, which is odd. What does Morn have to do otherwise than just seeing a celebrity? So why not?
Only a couple of other things I've got on this one. I think Neela would have worked much better had she been seeded in the earlier episodes as originally planned. Chief O'Brien's assistant in an earlier show should have been the girl who went on to be this, and for whatever reason that actress was let go, and so you had a cursory appearance from Neela in Duet, whereas she should have been seeded much earlier than that, and I think that would have worked. And the no ending isn't very good, is it?
Yeah, Sisko doing his Superman leap to take her down.
Yeah, and his impression of Anakin Skywalker.
It did have a very sort of and I don't know whether this movie was out at the time, but the one with Clint Eastwood in the Line of Fire. I'm wondering if it has kind of allegory to that. But
that's another good Clint Eastwood movie.
I think that was out already before this.
Okay, well, maybe they're sort of homaging into that a bit. But I don't have any more notes for this. Do you guys?
No.
Okay.
Barile's look at Wynne at the end when he knows what she's done is a wonderful little subtle setup for what's going to happen in the opening of season two. Mm-hmm. For other than
I guess I would just say that what I love, one of the things I really like about this is they all know what she did,
yep.
but they also are powerless to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and they fully realize it.
Kira emotionally, because then she starts to question her faith. And that's the direct opposite of what Wynne wants.
But it's also great that Sisko is there to say that her faith should not be shaken. It's just Wynne who's
yep.
wrong. Her faith
Which
is not
again,
wrong.
It's the point that we've been trying to make throughout this discussion. Religion is not the problem. Wynne is the problem.
Mm-hmm. It's the people who manipulate religion for their own needs and their own wants. That's the problem with religion. Wow, this was a heavy episode.
It was an incredibly heavy episode. A very, very well-mounted and impressive episode. Very well acted. Very well written. Yes, I don't disagree with Paul and his little piss-takey of it as being funny. But like I've said, religion and politics and news and politicians and all that stuff, it isn't subtle when they display it on the news. So should Star Trek really try to bury it in subtlety, or should it try and just address it in the guise of people with funny noses and silly hats?
I think this one does it as well as they really can.
Oh, I think they'll get better than this as they go along.
Oh, yeah. Well, but this was a great introduction for the Bajoran religious characters. And, well, for the major Bajoran religious characters. We've had Kai Opaka prior to this, but we're seeing some of the backhanded dealings of the Bajoran religion coming out, and it's only going to get better from here.
Yeah, well, they're going to build on this, but I think at this point, this was done, like I said, again, I can't, you know, I don't want to ever say like it was subtle, because it wasn't, but I think it was presented in a very good way. I think they couldn't have done it a whole lot better than they did. I think the other episodes that do it, and if we find that they did do it better, it's because they build on what went on here, not because they're doing it differently than what went on here.
Okay, well, if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and give my my ratings and final thoughts. I'm going to give this a 4 bars of Gold Press Latinum. I agree with you. There were parts of this that weren't subtle, but it was a great story that made you think. And that's what Star Trek and good science fiction should make you do. It should give you ideas, let you ruminate them, either in your own mind or with some friends on a podcast, and allow you to try and discover new ideas and new thoughts. And this does it really, really well. So 4 bars for me.
I'm exactly in the same camp. 4 bars. I think it's really thought-provoking. It's well-presented. Gives us a new villain who I enjoy very, very much as a villain. Presents a lot of political intrigue, a lot of religious intrigue, and shows how people are going to be torn as to where to go in the future, and really sets the stage for a lot that's going to come.
I was really torn on this one. I really did keep wavering between 4 and 5, because every other episode I've just gone with the gut feeling, and I've gone with my gut feeling of what the rating is. This one is provocative and slightly subversive, and ultimately I realized that I was giving it 5 because of where it takes the show from now on, and judging it just as an episode itself, I think I have to go with 4.
So yeah. We're all in agreement on the 4s.
Yeah,
I think that's very good. You know, since we know what's going to happen with Kai Winn and, well, oops. With Vedic
Winn. With Kai Winn on Terok Nor.
On Terok Nor, yes. Well, since we know what's going to be happening with Winn and what's going to be happening with Brile, this is all just a good setup for it, and it does allow you, since we have knowledge of what's coming on after this, to give this episode more importance. So I think that's a really good idea to downgrade it from a 5. I mean, putting what we know coming up into this episode would be kind of doing a disservice. But I do like the fact that it does lay the groundwork for some upcoming episodes and some upcoming story ideas that really, 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 really make the show good.
I also think the idea that somehow a 4 is a subpar rating is wrong.
Well, so far the only episodes there, aside from last time's duet, the only episodes we've given a 4 or higher have been Emissary, The Negus, and Duet. Those are the only ones so far this season. You know, we've had some pretty bad ones, and we've had some pretty good ones. Do we want to give an overview of this season? Do we want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
You know,
first, did we also talk about the possibility of if anybody had an episode that their opinion has changed on over the course of the year?
No. I don't think I've changed my I was holding back on the 5 throughout the entire year. I don't think there's any that I would change the grading on. I don't think, no, none of them leap out at me. I mean, I think the only one in retrospect of the entire run of the show, I would upgrade In the Hands of a Prophets to a 5. Like I say, but just judging it in and of itself, it's a 4. But in terms of its overall importance, I think that's the only one I'd vary on.
Yeah, I'm looking at my grades. You know, the one that I had the most divergence with you guys with was The Passenger. And
na 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 na.
Yes, that, I should have known it was Iggy Pop and not Susie and the Banshees. So there's my fault there. You know, I gave it a 3.5. Looking at the rest of the episodes, I might drop it down to a 3, but I still really enjoyed that. So that would be the only one that I might change. But I'm pretty satisfied with most of my rankings.
I'm trying to take a quick look to see ones where I was off, the more significantly off from you guys. Q-less, I gave a 1, Andy you gave it a 2, and Sean you gave it a 3. But I still kind of despise that episode, so that's not a problem. Otherwise, I mean, I don't think we varied that greatly. The Storyteller, Andy, you gave it a 3, and I gave it a 1.5.
What about Move Along Home?
Move Along Home.
We were all ones, except
Sean
you.
And I both gave it a 1, and you gave it a 1.5.
Yes.
Well, that's still not high, is it? Let's be honest.
No.
No, but you were left in the role of defending the episode.
Well, you know, yeah, you basically kept Paul and I from giving it a 0.5, so.
No, you didn't. No, I had it down as a 1 all along. I never changed my thought process on it at all.
Okay.
What do you think of overall as a season?
Well, I'm going to say for a first season, I've seen, especially compared to what came prior to this, compared to Next Generation. Next Generation's first season was very uneven. There were some good episodes in there, and then there was the Naked Now.
That's not the worst episode of the first season, dude. Have you ever seen A Code of Honor?
Yes, I've seen A Code of Honor. I just blocked it from my
Justice. Which is at least watchable because the people aren't worrying very much. But other than that.
Yeah, compared to Next Gen, this season has a lot more high points than. And even going on to the first season of Voyager. The first season of Voyager, they tried to maintain the sort of Star Trek Deep Space Nine overarching story. It just didn't work, and maybe it was because I just wasn't all that engaged with the Voyager crew, but for Next Generation Star Trek series, this first episode was probably, in my opinion, one of the best.
Of course, Sean meant to say first season rather than first episode. The coffee must be wearing off by this time.
So.
Yeah, I think except for the original series. I think the original series is the only one where the first season was its best season. Next Generation, Voyager, Enterprise, Deep Space Nine, of those four shows, I think this is the best first season. I think this, you know, there were some highs and lows, no question about it. But I think that we developed this world and we developed some characters. And we gave ourselves somewhere to go. And by we, I mean them. I think they did a good job of it. I think they made it intriguing. I think they made it so that we want to come back and see more and see where this is going to go to. This one, more than any of the other shows, except for, I guess, Voyager, had an overarching feel that it was an ongoing narrative as opposed to individual episodes. And I really like the feel of the show going into season 2, and I mean it's easy to say it knowing where the show is going to go, but I'm excited about getting to season 2 and getting into it and seeing where it goes. And even though I know where it goes overall. I don't remember all the individual episodes, and I'm looking forward to seeing them. If I remember right, I think we get a little bit into the Maquis now and more into the political and religious intrigue, and I think that's going to be fun to do.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to look at the parallels between this and Next Gen. Next Gen spent its first season trying not to be the original and finally stepped out from that shadow towards the end of the first season, only to have it completely blown up by the writer's strike. So the second season started with a script from Star Trek Phase 2. This spent its entire first season trying to get out of the shadow of the Next Generation and succeeds admirably. But the lack of a writer's strike means it just jumps into Season 2 and runs. I've not watched any of Season 2 since it originally aired in 1993-94. So I am very much looking forward to seeing where they go from this point.
I've written down on my spreadsheet, I've got the names of the episodes. I know the first three episodes kind of deal with what happened here. There's more dealings with the political shenanigans on Bajor. I'm looking at episodes. We've got the Cardassians coming up. We've got a episode called Rules of Acquisition, so I'm assuming we're going to have more dealings with Quark and the Negus. There's There's Blood Oath, where we get more relationship with the Klingons and Dax. We get the introduction of the Maquis. And at the end of Season 2, we get the introduction of the Jem'Hadar, which
we're
going to play.
Don't forget, Mirror Universe Kira's in this season, dude.
Is she?
Oh, yes.
Which episode is that?
The crossover.
Woohoo.
I'm looking forward to that. Not only because, you know, it's going to be a good episode, but yeah, Kira's going to be all sexy. Yeah. All right. Well,
and you know what? Just in hindsight, because we keep talking about, oh my God, seven seasons. This is going to take us forever. This is going to be, you know, in 10 years when we're done with this. Season one felt like it went really fast to me.
Me too.
Yeah, it didn't seem. There was not really. Well, there were a couple of episodes that were slogs, but they were fun slogs. I mean, it was fun taking the piss out of Alan Rain. Or Move Along Home, or whatever the heck the name of the show was. So, overall, yeah, this was a really impressive first season, and I'm glad we're going to be moving on to the second season. In fact, Andy, do you, if we're done with this, do you want to give us a next time?
Do we have a next time? Next time! It's season two!
That's perfect. Yeah, we'll be covering season. It's called The Homecoming, and I guess I could pull up on Netflix to see what it's doing, but I don't really know. So next time out, it's going to be The Homecoming, the start of Season 2 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
It's a three-parter, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think, The Homecoming, The Circle, and The Siege are the names of the episodes. I know it's a three-parter. I know it deals with, like I said, political shenanigans on Bajor. It deals more with Beryl. I know that, Perry White from Superman Returns is there.
Oh yeah, Frank Langella, isn't it?
Yeah, Frank Langella. He comes in as a character in the show. So, yeah, if you're into Dracula from 1979, you know, there's your gun.
Wasn't he in Masters of the Universe?
Yeah, he was Skeletor.
He was Skeletor.
Oh yes, so Skeletor comes to Deep Space Nine.
That may be our episode title.
Skeletor. That's what we have to do for the next time. So, thanks everyone for downloading and listening. We appreciate it, and keep those cards and letters coming. We'd love to have more emails, and once again, thanks for listening to Listen to the Prophets. Catch you all next time.
And you know what, everybody? Go on, if you like this show, I know we're a little bit of a niche cult thing here, go on to iTunes and give us some ratings. Maybe we'll start showing up and people will start discovering us.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say give us ratings, I mean 5 stars. 5 bars of Goldcrest Latin.
I wonder if we can petition, you know, iTunes to change it from stars to bars of Latin.
Something to consider.
visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Later, Neeler approaches Wynn in a private and
I think it also, Agent Carter also benefits from the fact that one of the main criticisms about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. from the get-go was, you know, well, Captain America's not in it, Thor's not in it, which is a criticism, I'll be honest with you, I didn't understand. And it's the same thing in the post-Avengers movies as well. Have you two found this? People are saying, well, why does Thor not show up to help Iron Man? Mm-hmm. Well, that's not how it works in the comics. Thor doesn't show up in Iron Man to help Iron Man with every one of his problems. Just because they exist in the same universe, I don't pop over and help you fix your door, but we exist in the same world. It's the same thing. But the thing, the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., everyone seemed to be expecting the superheroes to show up on a semi-regular basis, and they were never going to do that. No. So Agent Carter has the benefit of not having that stigma. Because it's taking place in the 40s, there aren't any yet. So you've not got an audience of people going, why's Thor not showing up? I mean, I know Angela would probably be pleased if Thor showed up. But...
Well, and they make mention of it, and sometimes they name drop them a little too much in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But that's okay. I can live with that. You know, now, Sean, did you watch last week's episode?
Of Agent Carter. No, I'm, yeah. I think I'm up to episode 3. I've got the one on DVR. Let's see. What's the
last
one?
You should have two on DVR then, because this was just episode 5.
Okay. Yeah. I've seen the one where they're tracking down the guy with the, I think the last one I saw was the guy with the ice cream truck that had all the orbs full of explosive shit in it. And at the end of it, they knocked. Is that the second of the?
That was 2 or 3.
Okay. So I've got a couple.
A little behind, so I'm not gonna give you my speculation then, because I don't want to spoil.
Okay. Well, I've been loving it. You know, of all the shows that I'm watching, all the comic book shows that I'm watching, I'm only watching a few. I'm still watching Walking Dead, but that really doesn't count. But The Flash, I've been loving. Constantine has been really impressive. And
is it?
Yeah, because
I've been waiting for Michael to be in to watch them, so I've not watched past episode 3, but he's never bloody around. Bloody teenagers.
See, they've introduced a lot of interesting characters. They've explained, why Chaz is able to come back from the dead. I don't know whether or not that's consistent with what happened, or if
with Hellblazer.
With Hellblazer, yeah. They've introduced Papa Midnight. The Spectre has shown up, Jim Corrigan, the actual Jim Corrigan Spectre, and they even had a scene at the end where he was kind of surrounded by this ghostly green energy. I mean, they're not sitting on their laurels in Constantine. I think they're doing really, and he's becoming, Constantine's a dick at times.
Good.
So it's impressing me a lot more than I expected it to.
Well, at this point, I may just wait till it finishes then. Yeah, I may just wait till it finishes then and screw Michael and watch them all back to back, because they're only doing 13, aren't they?
Yeah, it's kind of up in the air whether or not it's going to be renewed. There's been, you know, you see hits on Facebook or little Newsarama articles saying that, you know, Constantine isn't on NBC's renewed list yet, so we'll have to see.
It's on an odd channel being on NBC, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, but we're going to have that Teen Titans show on TBS or TNT. It's the one of the Turner networks. And then CBS is supposed to have the Supergirl show. So that's just, they're all over the place.
I'd have thought that would have been a much better fit on CW.
Exactly.
But maybe they think with Arrow and Flash, they've already got too many.
Well, I don't know. I think it would be nice if they could tie, you know, that universe into the Supergirl universe as well. I don't know. I'd like to see a shared TV universe, but having them all on separate channels is just going to complicate it even more. It's going to have, well, we can't have this kind of crossover because we have the rights to this and blah, blah, blah. So it's much like the Marvel, Sony, Fox thing, where it's going to be difficult to get the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, or the X-Men into an Avengers movie. Unless you finagle it with, you know, having different characters like the Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver being the only ones I've seen they're going to be crossing over.
It's going to be interesting to see how the audience reacts to that, because Quicksilver was the best thing about Days of Future Past.
Yeah, I'll have to say that. I mean, I didn't dislike the movie, but he was the standout part of it.
It was the Superman plane rescue for that film.
Essentially, yeah. That scene was phenomenal.
The rest of it, not so much.
It was okay. I mean, it was a big step down from what they did with First Class, but
you know, put it all on Bryan Singer.
Yeah, well, I do.
I do. I'm not.
I don't know who wrote it. I don't know if they got the same writers from the last time, but yeah, I could probably say Bryan Singer.
Lost all respect for whoever it was who was writing that. When the reason he gave for changing the stories was, well, Kitty Pryde can't go back in time because she wasn't alive then, so we can't transplant her mind back into her younger body. And I read that quote before I knew anything else about the film, and I just went, but that's not the Days of Future Past story. The story takes place in the future, and she's traveling back to now. So they completely changed, just from that one line, I got that they've completely changed the story. So I'm just not interested. You don't put Ellen Page in your film and then waste her. But they put Hugh Jackman in and wasted him.
Yeah, all he did was basically stand around and observe. And
yeah,
you know,
he didn't do anything.
Yeah, he had like one scene at the beginning where he fought some of the, you know, mafia-esque thugs that were trying to take him down because he was screwing around with some girl. That was about it. Other than that, he was just casually observing things going on.
I want them to do Wolverine 3, so that's not Hugh Jackman's last appearance as Wolverine.
I it really irritated me, the whole, you know, Magneto saying, you know, yes, and you have to get me too. And then Magneto's the one who f***ed up the whole thing. It's like, really? Why the hell did you tell me to save you? You could have just left you in that prison and actually done what we're supposed to do here without any problems.
I just thought it was meh. After First Class, where they finally made an X-Men movie, and I was the only one who wasn't dancing in the streets that Bryan Singer was coming back, because I knew what would happen. But I don't like Bryan Singer's films. I've come to the conclusion he's, to me, what Chris Nolan is to Scott. I think Singer's films are boring and devoid of human emotion and very clinically well-made, but just not interesting. Even X-Men 2, the more I watch it, the more I think, well, other than the X-Mansion Berserker Rage bit, this is a bit dull.
Well, for his superhero movies, I could probably give you that. You know, I didn't mind. He did, prior to doing the X-Men films, I liked, what was it, Usual Suspects. That was an interesting movie.
That was great.
And
try watching it again, though, when you know the twist.
Okay.
And it's not as good.
And, well, I was going to say Apt People, but Apt People was kind of marginal. I like if you ever read the short story, and I don't know if it was King or Bachman, or he was doing it as Bachman, but the short story has
King.
A much different ending.
Different seasons.
It wasn't in different seasons? Okay. Because the ending to that is vastly different from what I remember. Instead of, it basically ends with the kid, sitting by a roadside with a sniper rifle, taking out people, if I recall.
It took all night to take him down. I remember the exact line, but that was how the book ended, it took all night for them to take him down. Hmm.
But, you know.
I was riveted when I read that story. Hmm. Back in the 1980s. But, I think Bryan Singer has his own agenda, and much like, like the bad comic, directors, doesn't really care so much what he does with the source material. And that bothers me. And it also bothers me that the quotes and comments that he made about how, Brett Ratner had screwed up the series, the thing, and he came in to fix it. Well, you know what? You were supposed to do the third movie, and you turned around and walked away from them because they didn't want to give you an extra 3 years to wait. So maybe you shouldn't be so critical of everybody else. I thought he just considered himself above it all. I thought his ego really took a hold of him when he went over to do Superman Returns, and it hasn't let go yet. So I have a real problem with him. I don't like him as a person or as a director at this point.